Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The year 2025 was interesting for all the wrong reasons. Wars and increasing tensions developed globally. Conflict resolution was not a hallmark of the year. On this edition of the program, we have a look at some of the highs and low points of the year. Crosstalking 2025, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which we found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Before we talk about the year ending, I wanted to briefly touch upon the Kabuki Theater of Mar-a-Lago that we just recently saw. Mark, did it move the needle at all? And I was really quite surprised that the former president of Ukraine was announcing U.S. policy, apparently when he was on his plane trip back home. What were your thoughts about the entire staged event, Mark?
Is there a needle? I mean, is there a process? Is there anything? It has no relation to anything, right? It feels like I'm sure that the Kiev regime feels that they're going through the motions, right, in order to put the United States off. Meanwhile, the at least part of the Trump administration, those closest around the president, Witkoff, Kushner, those who are actually, it seems, to some level committed to some type of peace process, they appear feckless. They have no ability to exert leverage over the Kiev regime, quite obviously. I mean, he presented a 28-point plan, and we were told that Zelensky should sign it by Thanksgiving. And then that was it, right? And now here we are past Christmas, and Zelensky is presenting his own 20-point plan to Trump, and with the expectation that Trump should approve it, I guess. And no progress has been made. None of Russia's substantive issues have been addressed. They can argue amongst themselves between the Americans, the Kiev regime, the Europeans, but they haven't even begun to negotiate with Russia, and they keep getting further and further from anything Russia would accept, while Russia keeps advancing further and further on the battlefield. And the latest comment from the Russian president with regard to this is they are no longer even interested. They have zero interest in a Kiev regime withdrawal from the Donbas, from Kherson or Zaporozhye at this point, because they are meeting their goals militarily, and that seems to be the preferred solution at this point.
Well, George, Mark used the phrase going through the motions. Is Trump going through the motions too? I mean, because if you compare his meeting with Zelensky and later with Netanyahu, he seemed far more engaged when it came to his Gaza plan than the hijacked plan of his own for Ukraine.
Well, I think Trump may well be going through the motions. I mean, I think he does genuinely want to bring this war to an end. That desire is in conformity with the national security strategy, which is somehow we bring security and stability on the European continent, and that somehow he will work towards improving relations between Europe and Russia. However, he hasn't been willing to exercise the leverage that would be necessary to bring about some sort of a settlement. And as things stand, you have the Europeans and the Ukrainians who are seeking to maneuver Trump into making all sorts of very dangerous commitments. I mean, obviously with the security guarantees, that's the key. And then a lot of mumbo jumbo about, oh, well, we'll kind of withdraw some forces, but then you create a kind of a free trade zone inside Donetsk, and that might appeal to Trump. Oh, and we'll have a referendum, but of course during the referendum we need to have a ceasefire, and of course the goal here obviously is to provoke a Russian rejection, and then to confront Trump with saying, hey, this is your plan, this is the Trump-Ukraine plan, and Russia has shown you the back of its hand, what are you going to do about it now? You know, now you really have to throw the weight of the United States thoroughly behind the Ukraine and the European plans. So this is all an attempt to maneuver Trump into doing something he really doesn't want to do. But on the other hand, Trump doesn't have the strength or the leverage or the will or the capability to affect what he, I think, wants to do. And so I think we're in an impasse. We're basically going nowhere. A year later, we're going nowhere.
I wonder if we'll be convening exactly 1 year from now and having the same conversation. Well, we'll leave that to the side. Mark, what happened in 2025? Is there a structural change, a narrative change, a power dynamic change? It's a simple question that doesn't have a simple answer. What happened in 2025 in your mind?
Yeah, I think the one event that has ripple effects on everything else and is probably the most significant event of the year is the detonation of a weapon of mass destruction on the world. And that is the Trump chaos bomb. And with Trump assuming office in the United States for a second administration, we saw everything from the U.S. Bombing, by my count, Iran, Syria, Somalia, now Nigeria as well, random ships in the Caribbean Sea, starting a trade war with the world. On and off regime change, Iran and Venezuela. It has been a wild ride, and Trump has been, I think, you know, the title event that has been driving much of it.
Yeah, George, has the West global liberal order come to an end? Did it come to an end in this year?
I don't think it's come to an end yet, but it is very shaky. I do think that there is a certain rhyme and reason to Trump. I mean, I think that his attempt to get the kind of the transatlantic Western alliance into some kind of rationality, in some sort of way in which it serves American interests, I think that is a significant change from previous administrations, you know, that all had espoused, oh yes, the transatlantic alliance, the greatest alliance in the history of the universe. I think Trump isn't buying that. I think he is trying to bring some kind of rationality to it, in some ways conform to what is in America's interest. And I think that is the, you know, I don't think it's entirely a chaos bomb. I do think Trump somehow has almost from the beginning tried to redefine U.S. foreign policy as somehow serving American national interests rather than some nebulous, ineffable global order. So that I think is the change. How he has implemented it, I think, is a very different question. And I think the way he has implemented it has been somewhat chaotic and hasn't really delivered for Trump. You know, so far, but you know, it doesn't look particularly promising. But he hasn't delivered for Trump what I think he was seeking to deliver.
Yeah, I mean, who's gotten anything out of this, Mark? How do you react to that? Because you know, we have three more years of this guy. Can NATO survive Trump?
Yeah, I have to admit that it's obvious that George is in on Trump's 5D chess plays. I have to admit they're beyond my grasp. They're just beyond my intellectual capability to discern any order or rationality in them. I'll leave, you know, Trump's master plan to George. But yeah, NATO will survive. right? It is going through a bad phase. The whole transatlantic relationship, as is very predictable, is suffering under the bad relations between Trump and the Europeans, and not just on Ukraine, although that is a principal point of it. It must be said, if Trump's plan is to reorientate or reinvent NATO to serve a new vision of U.S. interests or a new interpretation of hegemony, and if Trump is really committed to somehow ending the conflict in Ukraine, then he's doing a very bad job of it, because the Europeans are just thumbing their noses at him and continuing the war. Now, he's also providing them weapons for this war while they have to pay for it. So there is another possibility, and that is the U.S., as defined in the U.S. national security strategy, basically a division of labor and in burden sharing, while the U.S. Retreats and retrenches to the Western Hemisphere, it pushes its proxies forward to deal in with Russia, the Europeans, in the Pacific, the Philippines, the Japanese, the South Koreans, the Taiwanese, in the Middle East, the Israelis. But I have real difficulty seeing Trump as the guiding light between this reinterpretation of hegemony. I would rather look to some, shall we say, more internationally educated people in his administration, like Elbridge Colby, who is a radical but is still committed to U.S. hegemony, just the reinterpretation of it.
Right before we go to the break, George, do you agree with that? I mean, this is just, it's the same pig, it's just different lipstick.
No, I think it's a little different from that. I think that, as articulated by that national strategic document by Elbridge Colby, we assume that it was written by Colby, I think that gave a kind of an intellectual heft to what Trump has been saying since 2015, which is we're going to have basically three global powers, and there'll be competition among them. But okay. They won't go to war.
All right, George, I'm going to jump in here, but we're going to continue with that thought when we return. All right, we're going to, after our short break, we'll continue our discussion on the year 2025. Stay with RT.
Того, что на Украине с 2014 года шла гражданская война, для черной трансплантологии Украина стала это просто золотым дном.
Это Израиль, это Германия, Канада, Франция. Они очень заинтересованы в украинцах, потому что это дешевый материал, платить много не надо.
Там были найдены тела, которые вот находились без органов.
Бойцов скрывали на линии боевого соприкосновения.
Когда будет произведена демилитаризация Украины, будет военный трибунал, будет отдельное слушание по черным трансплантологам. Большой и очень серьезный судебный процесс.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the year 2025. Okay, let's go back to George. George, before we went to the break, you were talking about a new dynamic, you know, three major centers of power. Obviously, the United States is going to be one of them. China, Russia could be one. India could be another. Basically, a kind of spheres of influence where the major power will have privileges. That's a shorthand saying there's no international law and there'll be limited sovereignty for those in that sphere. But, I mean, it's something that all three of us have talked about during the course of the year. And this is this return of great power politics, something that very much akin to what we witness historically in the 19th century. Is that the direction you think we're going into? And is it any safer than what we've experienced over the last 80 years?
I think it is, and I think it's the National Security Strategy document makes clear that well, the United States is looking to have stable relations with peer powers, and that includes China, and that includes Russia, whereas the alternative, which has been the kind of the Cold War plus, you know, post-Cold War ideology, which is somehow we've got to beef up, build up the transatlantic alliance, that I think is distancing itself from that because that is dangerous for the United States. And I think Trump and Elbridge Colby have really articulated the point that this NATO expansion, this NATO project is actually very dangerous for the United States, that it's really not a good idea to go down that path because it's leading to war with peer powers. And I think that I think is the way, you know, the Trumpian worldview is shaping up. Robert, both in the National Security Strategy document and in the original 28-point plan, it made clear no more NATO expansion. So why do they say no more NATO expansion other than, you know, the realization this is not a good idea? We want to have good relations with Russia. That goes back to Trump circa 2015, 2016, because it is a great power. You don't get into wars with great powers. And even with China, you know, everyone assumed that, oh, he's planning on going to war with China. The same thing with the National Security Strategy document talks about a kind of a relationship, a competition with China, but absolutely falling short of anything that could lead to a military confrontation.
Yeah, you know, Mark, people that are pleased to see the return of geopolitics in the sense of the 19th century, I inconveniently point out that that system did end up with the First World War that shattered multiple empires here. I don't know, can you have a stable order when you have these different major powers with the kind of technology that we have today?
Okay, first of all, I think geopolitics has always been with us. I think it's more the prism through which what by at least some standards is still the world's foremost power, if a fading hegemon, the way that the U.S. government is looking at those geopolitics. And they're looking at it through a realist international relations theory prism rather than, say, the liberal hegemony through at which previous administrations, right? The Blinken-Sullivan administration that preceded the Trump administration was committed to conflict with Russia, China, and Iran all at the same time. And they thought that not only could they do that, but that they should do that, that they had a moral imperative to do that. And the Trump administration doesn't. It's taking cracks at Russia and then backing off and then cracks at Iran and finding that Iran's not so easy to knock over either and initiating a trade war with China and then getting bent over the barrel by China over that and then deflecting off and deciding that Venezuela looks like the lowest hanging fruit in the room to mollify the U.S. need for aggression. So that is at least a more realistic assessment of U.S. power in the world. That said, it is even more aggressively pushing its proxies forward to conflict. The largest U.S. arms package to Taiwan in history, just presented by the Trump administration, continuing supplies of arms and intelligence to the Kiev regime, large supplies of weapons to the Europeans. Yeah, the Europeans are paying for it, but they're still being used to kill Russians in the conflict in Ukraine. This is a proxy forward foreign policy that Trump is pushing. It is a bit more realistic assessment, but it is not giving up on U.S. hegemony. It is simply taking a step back with the hopes that the U.S. can reindustrialize itself. And I believe that's part of Trump's tariff plans or delusions, depending on where you want to look at it. They think somehow that is going to help reindustrialize the U.S. and that would lead to a increase in military production and capability. But quite honestly, I don't see any of that being a likely result of what Trump is doing geoeconomically. On the world.
Well, reindustrialization, that's not going to happen under one administration. That's just simply unrealistic. You know, George, as we end this year, we have, as we've mentioned in the first part of the program, the conflict in Ukraine. There seems to be no end to it, at least at this point. And then we had the other meeting in Mar-a-Lago with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, which the United States appears to be committed to dealing with Iran under Israel's terms. How does that work with the national security strategy? I mean, we have talked about this at great length. I mean, there is a kind of projection of where they want to see policy go, but we see a policy in action still defaulting to old habits. George.
That's a really very good question because, you know, here is apparently this redefining of national interest, redefining of great power competition. And then the Trump administration, it gets distracted. I mean, we had the distraction of Venezuela, and now we have the distraction in the Middle East. But as always with Trump, it's not at all clear what exactly he's actually saying. So yeah, the Israeli media are, you know, cock-a-hoop with Trump. Oh yeah, he's signed on to this plan to attack Iran. We're gonna go after the Iran's ballistic missiles. Great, he's with us. That's not quite what Trump actually said. You know, if you look carefully, what he was saying is that yes, if Iran revives its nuclear program, then United States goes into action. I think it's very dubious to assume that he indeed would back Israel in any Israeli attack on Iran's ballistic missiles, for the obvious reasons that the attack in June of this year really wasn't a great success. I mean, it was basically Israel had to call in the United States because Israel was not really coping with Iran. And at least the United States came in, okay, well, we'll deal with the nuclear issue because that's longstanding U.S. policy to address Iran's nuclear issue. But Israel incurred huge losses as a result of that. And, you know, Iran showed that it can hurt Israel over and over again. And basically, Israel was bailed out by the United States. I don't think Trump really wants to go down that path again, and particularly on an issue like Iran's ballistic missiles.
Well, I'm not an expert in body language, but he seemed very enthusiastic with Netanyahu's visit. Apparently, according to Washington gossip, the only fan Netanyahu has left in Washington is Donald Trump. You know, Mark, you know, we hear a lot about America first and trying to understand this and with the new national security strategy, America first. I think the more I think about it, it's just Trump first. That's what I would call American foreign policy, Trump first.
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty good way of looking at it. I mean, every president imagines that his conception of U.S. national interests is, you know, the right one, of course. But there has been a from administration to administration, a lot of overlap, shall we say, very little difference between administration. Trump obviously has a significantly different conception of what U.S. national interests are. But ultimately, he finds himself just as constrained as he did in his first administration by the fact that the U.S. president is actually not all that powerful. That he is constrained by, if you want to call it, the deep state, the blob, the U.S. foreign policy elite, the permanent bureaucracy, right, the State Department, the intelligence community, the Pentagon, the military industrial complex, both parties in Congress, which are hostile to his foreign policy plans, it must be said, the media, you know, everything else. He has very little room to divert the Titanic from its course, I think. Even if that course was just to take it into another iceberg, the U.S. State is bent on that iceberg, right? You know, that he wants to take it towards. So ultimately, I think Trump is proving to be a very weak president. He doesn't have the ability to exert.
That's my next question here, and we're rapidly running out of time. George, is, at least in terms of foreign policy, is Trump a strong leader?
No, I don't think he is. I think he has a vision, and I think the vision has been quite consistent, you know, even long before he became president. But he doesn't have the capability of actualizing his vision. So he resorts to sending out truths. He resorts to bluster. But he doesn't really have the ability to put forward some kind of a coherent agenda around which he could at least build some kind of a coalition. And that's why it seems like he goes from one thing to another. But if you just look at what he wanted to accomplish in his second term, I think he's very far from accomplishing it. This the Ukraine, I think we're very, very far from any kind of a resolution of this. He keeps saying, oh, wouldn't have happened had I been president. Okay, you've now been president for almost a year. It's still ongoing. And even when it comes to the Middle East and his Gaza and everything else, he's still far from accomplishing what he wanted. And I think he doesn't have the kind of strength that, let's say, someone like Richard Nixon had. You know, Nixon knew what he wanted to do and set about doing it. Deviously, obviously, but nonetheless, effectively.
Yeah. Well, we're leaving 2025 with a lot of dangling threads, okay? I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.